May God bless you. And until next time, remember to keep on praying.
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295 or 831-464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being until we ask for calls, because we have with us this evening Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. We're going to be talking about the Declaration of Independence, which is really the almost like the birth certificate of America. And the trouble is that most people don't understand the Declaration of Independence, and yet certainly the founding fathers of this country understood how important it was. If you ever read the Gettysburg Address, that starts off with those wonderful words, 47 years ago our forefathers brought forth in this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men were created equal. Well, the speech was given, of course, in 1863, 47 years before was 1776. And the concept that all men were created, that there was a God that created individuals, was immortalized in the Gettysburg Address, but it was also immortalized in our Declaration of Independence. And with that, America is no different than any other country. But here, for the first time in all recorded history, men were free because God gave them individual rights. That's where our rights come from. And that's, of course, why this declaration is played down and the attack on Thomas Jefferson. Why? Well, after all, they want us to embrace the United Nations Declaration of Rights, where the rights come from government. And, of course, whatever government gives, government can certainly take away. Well, that is the background. Pastor David Whitney, thank you so much for being with us again tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Stan, and you're absolutely right. Our far rights come from government. They're not secure, and people ought to remember that governments are unstable. That is, they change. They're not reliable and not trustworthy. You might have rights this month, and next month they might be taken away from you if they're in the hands of government. But the amazing thing that our founders recognized that was really perhaps the first time in Western history where this was codified into law is that our rights come from God, and therefore they can't be taken from us. A government may violate those rights, as King George III was doing, but that government cannot take those rights away. And, as they further stated, when a long train of abuses has been suffered by those under the tyranny of someone who is violating their God-given rights, another God-given right is to either abolish that form of government or to change and alter that form of government. And they chose to abolish the form of government and establish a government founded upon the laws of nature and nature's God. Well, you know, I think it's important for people to hear what that long train of abuses and usurpations were, because those are reflected sad to say, reflected in our own form of government today that has strayed so far from the founding principles. Our founders, I think, would find it unrecognizable form of government that we are under today.
And you know, really what a great tragedy is, that at one time everyone knew the words of the Declaration of Independence. It was read regularly, you know, in our halls, certainly in our legislative halls. It was read every 4th of July, so people would understand what it was that the founders of this country were objecting to. But we don't read that anymore. Why? Because there is a conspiracy against God. There is a conspiracy against our form of government, the highest levels. Well, with that as the background, David, why don't you pick up the story?
If we were to divide up, and if you were to ask the average person on the street, why did our founders separate from England? What were the reasons? What was the cause? Usually they come up with one cause: taxation without representation. And yet, if you read the list, there's actually 28 in that list, and there's only one mention of taxation, that one. But if you were to categorize the other major groupings of abuses on the part of King George III, there was abuses legislatively, like he refused to assent to necessary colonial laws. He dissolved colonial legislatures, said, you no longer are meeting, I'm going to rule you illegal and banished. And that he made administration of colonial justice impossible by controlling judges. So not only had he abused the legislative process, he was also abusing the judicial process. He along the judicial lines, he denied trial by jury, which our founders knew, going back way beyond even the Magna Carta, trial by jury was one of those God-given rights that every Englishman understood that he had. Part of that denial of trial by jury of one Piers was he transported the colonists for trial often to England. Now, in England, you wouldn't get a fair trial. After all, if you're not being tried by a jury of your peers who understand the situation, who know your character, all of those things were being denied by the King of England. So he was abusing the judicial process. He was abusing the legislative process. But even more violative of our God-given rights, he was abusing his power of military might. He kept standing armies in the colonies that were not subject to the control of colonial government. And as our founders knew, any time you have a standing army, it is a very dangerous thing. As a matter of fact, so dangerous that they codified into the Constitution that an army could only continue in any time, even if it's a time of war, it could only continue for 2 years without being appropriated by the Congress. That every 2 years, the Congress had to vote to keep a standing army going. Because they knew that a standing army, if it just sits around and no time of war, it will find a war, it will even create a war, just as we have here in Iraq today. Our founders would look at what's taken place in the past 100 years in our country and say, many of the abuses, this being one of them, the standing army, many of the abuses of King George III are ripe, and they're being done by our own form of government today. So the major reasons, taxation without representation was one minor one, but the major reasons was his abuse of the legislative process, his abuse of the judiciary.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney, and the things that the colonists objected to as far as the King of England was he certainly was violating the legislative process. He was not allowing the local legislatures to have their laws. He was violating the judicial process. He was taking people off to England to be tried. But one of the biggest objections was he had a standing army. And our founding fathers knew that if you had an army, why, you were going to use it. It's sort of like the old idea. If you have a hammer in your hand, everything looks like a nail. But if you have a standing army, that army is going to be used. And our founding fathers didn't want to be involved in wars. Of course, they did not understand that there were people even at that time who wanted to use America one day to become the major force in the world and to bring all nations together under this one world system of government. Today, America has troops stationed in 130 nations throughout the world. Do you honestly think that those troops are there to protect America? And we have troops stationed in Uzbekistan, although we're going to have to pull them out and they're going to one of the other stands, a couple of the other countries over there, but we have troops in 130 nations throughout the world. Our founding fathers would have been furious at this concept, because this is being used as an imperial concept. Our leaders are not interested in defending America. Our leaders are interested in controlling the world and forcing the world to do what our leaders want, which has nothing to do with what the average individual wants. There is a dream on the part of some of these people, and they believe in a one-world government, a one-world religion, and there are strong spiritual implications to everything that's going on today. But you go back 25, 35 years, and you find a group of people who were very, very concerned about these ideas of individual liberty. And they realized that the standing army was certainly something that would be feared, and it could be used against the people, as we're seeing the president is saying, oh, if we have another catastrophe, another major hurricane, or perhaps some sort of an outbreak or a plague or the bird flu, we're going to have the military really take over control of the country. And where is the outcry from the American people? Where is the outcry from our conservative leaders, from our Christian leaders, from our anti-communist leaders? When you have a military dispersed throughout the country, controlling that country, you have certainly the framework for a military dictatorship. And there really are people who would like to have a military dictatorship in this country, exactly as they would like to have it throughout the world. So with that as the background, Pastor Whitney, why don't you pick up the story?
Well, it's interesting because the abuse of the military did involve abuse of American citizens, and this took place on the high seas, that American sailors routinely, their ships were pulled up by a British frigate, and every person on board was taken captive and forced, that is, pressed into the English Navy. They didn't have any choice about it. They were immediately drafted into a foreign army, and the Americans said, this is intolerable. This is slavery. This is not freedom. This is not a God-given right that the king can imprison anyone he wants and force them to fight his wars for him. And yet our own government, as we know, has for more than 50 years had a draft. There's only a brief period of time in the past 50 years where there was not a military draft. And what is a draft? It is to force young men, and if we have another draft here, they're talking about young women as well, force young men and young women to do that which they voluntarily would not do, serve in the military to build this, as you say, a new world order, or a one world empire, whatever you want to call it, the empire building wars and military occupations around the world. That is an egregious violation of the basic principles upon which our country was founded. What our founders objected to of King George III, our current government is doing without a peep of protest from most Americans.
You know, it's so interesting, David, as you were talking about that. I remember, of course, in 1776, why they had Hessian soldiers. They had German mercenaries that were, of course, being utilized by the British Army. They didn't have enough Englishmen to do everything, so they were hiring German mercenaries to come. And, of course, there were many German mercenaries actually stationed here in the United States. What's really so interesting over in Iraq today, why there are about 20,000 mercenaries. Some of them are professional killers from the United States, trained in all sorts of military means, but some of them are from South Africa and from other countries throughout the world. These are mercenaries that we've sent over to Iraq that are not under any military discipline, a traditional military discipline. 20,000 of them, some of them were even brought to New Orleans during the flood. How many there were, a few hundred, but they were employed by a military organization known as Blackstone. But the similarities between the Hessian mercenaries that they had in 1776 and the Blackstone mercenaries we have today should really make people give a serious look at what's really going on. Who are these people answerable to? They're answerable to the people who are paying their salary. They're certainly not answerable to our country. They are certainly professional killers who are hired to maintain or to impose rule by force. 20,000 of them over in Iraq today.
And if the precedent has been set, we can almost be certain without any protest or cry out from the American people, it'll be repeated, which means we know that American soldiers might have problems shooting fellow Americans in the streets of America or taking guns from fellow Americans. But we know mercenaries, they wouldn't have any problem doing that at all, which is why most empires, the British Empire and this, I won't call it American, this New World Empire, have no problem using mercenaries, because they know that mercenaries far more likely are going to violate the citizens' God-given rights. As a matter of fact, when you look just a little bit further down in history, England tried to harass Americans at sea again, and this led to the War of 1812. One of the very reasons why we were willing to go to war against England again was that they were in pressing, that is, capturing on the high seas and forcing American sailors to become part of the empire unwillingly and basically being forced as slaves. And so Americans, I believe, should protest the draft for the right reason. Not because we're communists or want anything like that, but no, because the basic foundational principles of our country state that military service, unless it's a war attacking us, an invasion, and by the way, we have an invasion on our southern border, and the military is doing absolutely nothing to protect us from that invasion, but unless there's an invasion, no one should be drafted as a citizen of the United States for any foreign wars, and this is a principle followed very clearly through the 19th century. Only volunteers could fight in foreign wars. Nobody who was drafted could fight in a foreign war, because that was against the foundational principles of our nation. Well, along with the military abuses, of course, we have a number of other ones. He cut off trade that basically said the colonies could only trade with England, no other country, which greatly hampered their abilities as businessmen to do that. He had abolished the common law in Canada just to the north, setting an example, our founders believe, for what was going to come upon the colonies. And he had also incited insurrection and Indian warfare against the colonies. Basically, he was creating terror on the front border, the western border of our country, as colonists would move west and try to settle land. The king was actively involved in arming and paying for insurrection on the part of the Indians, warfare against the colonists, creating his own terror network, you could almost say.
It's almost as if he was financing the terrorists to attack the people to make them, of course, follow his rule. After all, he was there to protect them. So he created the terrorists, mm-hmm. at that time the Indians. So very, very similar to some
exactly.
of the things going on today.
Exactly. As you pointed out on many other programs, the New World Order has created the problem, terrorism, that they are supposedly solving by taking away or trying to abolish our God-given rights. Well, after the list of 28 reasons, of very serious reasons of violation of our God-given rights, they conclude that the King of England is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. And again, this is a pretty astonishing statement. These people are saying there is a standard. There is a standard that the King himself must be held to. The King is not above the law. The king is subject to the laws of nature and nature's God, and the king, having violated the laws of nature and nature's God, is no longer fit to be king. Now, they did this with some very recent history behind them there in England that set the groundwork. It's called the Glorious Revolution, when King Charles I was overthrown, and Oliver Cromwell's what was often called, and I believe correctly called, the Glorious Revolution. They established that English kings were not above the law, and if the king violated the law, he was to be held to the standard. And the standard was the laws of nature and nature's God. Which really brings me to question the attitude most Americans have today. They think what is legal is whatever the court decides. That's what the law is, and therefore if the court decides, for example, that killing unborn babies or even killing them at partial birth abortion, these things are all legal because, after all, the court has spoken. And instead of having a king as the tyrant in our day, today the courts have become tyrants. And we've spoken before about Terry Schiavo in Florida, one probate judge, a lowly judge actually in terms of the judicial system, way down the pecking order of judges. One judge in a black robe decrees that this woman's life is not worthy of living by his standard, by no other standard than his puny pea brain, and he decides that she is to be killed, and so remove her feeding tube and kill her. So we are under a tyranny no longer of one man, a king, but a tyranny of judges who are basically doing the same things the King of England was doing, violating the God-given rights that we the people have given us by God, and we the people have the right to alter and to abolish such form of government that abuses our God-given rights.
But I think what's so important is the fact that the determinant of what's right and wrong is not up to you and I, or even to the courts. It's really up to God.
Mm-hmm.
And God has his standards. You can read them in his holy scriptures. And that is what our founding fathers really believed. And that, as John Adams said, our system of government is made for moral and religious people. It would not suffice for any other. In other words, we had to have moral people. And what was the basis of that morality? Well, it wasn't what the judges said it was. It was what the Holy Scripture said it was, and everybody knew that in 1776. But that, of course, is never taught today. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. David, pick up the story.
Well, they said after a long train of abuses and usurpations against the colony, they were now taking the step of declaring independence. We need to remember that they clearly communicated to the king his abuses. They sent letters to him. They sent petitions to him. And they mentioned in the declaration that these petitions were ignored. They were not responded to, whatever, but they continually sought to communicate clearly the violations that the king was engaged in before taking this step of declaring independence. And that's an important principle. Actually, it's really a biblical principle. We're told in the scriptures that if someone names the name of Christ, they claim to be the Christian, which the King of England did, and actually he was and still is the head of the Anglican Church, so he claims to be a Christian. For one Christian to have a problem with another Christian, where another Christian has wronged them, the process for which that is to be handled is first that they are to go to that person and confront him and tell him what he has done wrong, and if he refuses to repent, refuses to acknowledge that he has broken God's law, then they're to take others, and then if he refuses then, they're to ultimately take it to the church, and then the church is to have a trial basically to excommunicate them. Well, the problem here was, so, you know, the king is the head of the church, so the king kind of calls the shots there in the church as well, and so in essence, they can't finally excommunicate him, but they can come to this conclusion that he's unfit to be the ruler of a free people. And they did that having communicated clearly over more than a decade of the abuses that the king was involved with. And so all their efforts to resolve the grievances peaceably have gone unheeded. In fact, the king had begun war against them several years now before, not only just the Indians, but actually with British troops on the soil, that the war against them had begun a couple years before they actually signed the Declaration of Independence. And they state that these united colonies are, and of a right, that is a God-given right, ought to be free and independent states. And then they go on to say, with all the privileges that any independent state has, and friends in peace and enemies in war. And they state very clearly that they are relying upon God himself in forming this new government. It was a firm reliance upon divine providence. And they actually recognize that they were putting their lives and their fortunes on the line here. We know that the king, very shortly after receiving this, gave orders to his generals to go after the signers of the Declaration. All 56 suffered in some way. Some lost their lives, others lost their entire property, some lost their families that were killed because basically the soldiers were told, find these people, track them down, hunt them down, destroy their lands, their houses, and take their lives from them and the lives of their wives and children. And this happened again and again to those who signed the Declaration, with few exceptions. All of them suffered in a loss in some way, shape, or form. But we need to remember that the importance of the Declaration, as you mentioned earlier, is downplayed in our day for a very specific reason. The New World Order knows that it cannot get away with its evil design except by removing the foundation that underlies our form of government. And that foundation is the Declaration. I was in a debate here earlier this month with a professor of history at a college here in Maryland. And
hold that thought right there, David. We want to bring other stations right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Pastor Whitney is pointing out that the people on the other side, the people who hate freedom, realize that they must discredit the Declaration of Independence. So this is why it's not taught, it's not discussed. Everything is being done to undermine the concept that America was founded as a Christian nation, that the Supreme Court had originally held on a number of occasions that America was a Christian nation. And if you'd like to check the case of the Church of the Holy Trinity versus the United States, 1891-1892, that's the case of the Church of the Holy Trinity versus the United States, where the Supreme Court held that there were so many reasons why we were a Christian nation and listed so many of these. Understand that everybody until 50 years ago knew we were a Christian nation. The reason it's not known now is because five mega corporations control our media. That's Bertelsmann, Disney, Fox, Viacom, and AOL Time Warner. And they are all controlled by people who hate America, who hate freedom, who have an agenda. And if you control the mass media, you control what the people hear, read, and see. Ultimately, you control what they believe. So, with that as the background, we need to get back to understanding the importance of the Declaration of Independence, which was really our birthright. It was the very foundation upon which the freedoms of our country rest. And as long as they can continue concealing the message there that our freedom comes from God, why they can continue to erode our freedom. And remember, when the Supreme Court opens every one of its sessions, the crier comes in and says, God save the United States and this honorable court. I think they probably should say, God save the United States and this dishonorable court.
And
go ahead.
And God save this these United States from this dishonorable court.
All right.
Anyway, but earlier I had the debate with a history professor, so it's not just in the media these lies are being propounded, but in academia. And this professor basically was saying that the Declaration of Independence had very little, if any, connection at all with the founding of our nation in the Constitution, that the people of the Declaration and the people of the Constitution were entirely different. Yes, the people of the Declaration era were religious and they believed religion was important and da-da-da-da-da. But by the time 1787 rolled around, there was a vast transformation and the people no longer believed that religion was necessary to form a government and they were forming a secular state. All these things are absolute, total lies coming out of this history professor's mouth. But because he has a platform at that college and people will listen to him, actually the students have to listen to him in order to get their grades, you know, the lie is furthered, and that's part of the reason why we at Institute on the Constitution are teaching these things, because we recognize the media is not going to communicate these things to the people. The academia is going to communicate the lies instead of the truth, and many books published, and even many pastors, sadly, believe lies like all of our founders were a bunch of deists, and all these lies that are believed by so many Americans that we got to get around that and communicate the truth.
You know, they even teach this in many of our seminaries. They infiltrated our seminaries 50 to 75 years ago. Why? So that they could get the ministers to disbelieve in the foundations of our freedom, to believe that our founders were deists, that really very, very few people were Christians back in 1776. And, you know, it is amazing when you hear ministers get up and give this dissertation with no basis at all. In fact, and yet, of course, they were taught this in their seminaries. Also, they were taught, the basic tenet of the Bible is Romans 13, you know, we should simply go along with whatever the government says, you know.
Which isn't what that passage actually says.
It isn't. In fact, they were talking not about a representative government. They were talking about a tyranny that existed in Rome 2,000 years ago. But you see, the people who put out that lie, well, they're the same people who put it out in Hitler's Germany. And if you haven't read that wonderful book by Dr. Erwin Lutzer, entitled Hitler's Cross, which we do carry through our ministry, Dr. Lutzer of the Moody Bible College points out that they kept quoting Romans 13 in Hitler's Germany to neutralize the church. They kept quoting Romans 13 in Hitler's Germany to neutralize the church, just like they're doing this in America today to neutralize the church. Go ahead, David.
Well, what I argued, and I hope successfully to the audience, I know I didn't persuade the professor, he's of that ilk, but that the Declaration actually is the preamble to the Constitution. It explains the why The Constitution explains the how, the nuts and the bolts. The philosophy of government expressed in the Declaration is what was worked out in the details of the Constitution. So, of course, the Constitution doesn't talk about the whys. The whys had already been established in the Declaration, and a true understanding of the Declaration, an American understanding, is that it is the preamble to the Constitution. It's our birthright. It's our foundation. One nation built upon God's law, the laws of nature, and nature's God.
Well, I think it's so important that we, at least here, people who listen to our program are aware of the foundations of our freedom, which are built upon the Declaration of Independence, which created that all men were created equal. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney. And so, pick up the story there. David, what happened when you did debate this professor?
Well, the debate was very interesting because he shot out so many lies. I don't know if you ever go on skeet shooting where, clay pigeons are thrown up in the sky and you take a gun and you try to pop them all out. There were so many up there that I didn't have time. And the way the debate was structured, there wasn't enough time to shoot down all the lies, but I believe I shot down the most important ones, and actually with conversations with some of the students after the debate was over, convinced me that I made an impress, a dent in their thinking that, first of all, our founders believed in a creator God, not an evolution, but a creator God, that our rights come from that creator God, and the sole purpose, the absolute only reason for government, not a welfare state, the reason for government is to protect, defend, and secure your God-given rights. And I persuaded them that our current form of government is not doing that. It is actually violating your God-given rights by stealing property, as they're doing in New London, Connecticut, and by taking the person's right to life, whether it's the unborn 40-plus million dead or Terri Schiavo and other euthanasia issues going on. And the Supreme Court recently has been ruling on euthanasia. All these things taking place, I convinced some of those students, ought to have them worried that the trend, that the direction in the form of our government is against your God-given rights, and what they have taken so far is just the beginning of what they intend to take. So anyway, but there was a very good debate to point out to students that they need to be active on the forefront because their rights are on the line, and if they do not defend their rights, and all of our listeners should remember this, if you don't defend your rights, if you don't stand up and do something to defend your rights, you are going to have them violated by a tyrannical form of government, which is really why Institute on the Constitution got started. Michael Peruca and his brother Steve said that more than just being upset with what was going on in society, they needed to make a difference. And that difference, they recognized, begins by educating people in the foundations of what our nation is about, foundational documents of the Constitution, the Declaration, the Bill of Rights. So we put together what we call a host kit that really enables anyone with any group of people around the country to communicate these principles. We don't say teach them because actually the lecturer, Dr. John Eidsmo, constitutional law professor, he does that by means of a DVD and half-hour segments over 12 sessions. We put together a student notebook that gives
I'm going to ask you to hold off on that because we want, of course, all of our listeners out across America to hear what you're saying, and we're going to bring all of our stations on here in just a moment as they all come back into the network. But I want them to know about the Institute of the Constitution because it is an idea whose time has come.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. And certainly I want David to tell you about the Institute of the Constitution, what they have to offer, and how you can get in touch with them.
We're very excited, Dr. Stan, because out across the country in state after state, we have more classes being offered this year, 2005, than any of the years previous. That means more Americans are waking up to the reality that if they don't stand up to defend their God-given rights, they're going to lose the security of their God-given rights as the tyrannical form of government currently in power is pushing. And tyranny always moves as far as it's permitted. If it doesn't find any resistance, it just bulldozes over anything. And so we've got to stand up. The first thing we got to do is educate ourselves, our families, our churches. Most of all, churches should be teaching these foundational principles. So At Institute on the Constitution, we put together a host kit that enables anybody to do that. You don't have to be a historian or have any legal knowledge. You put together a program that gives 12 lectures by Dr. John Eisenow, and each student has a copy, a detailed outline of that lecture for the host. Then after the half-hour lecture shows, they lead the class through a series of discussion questions that help them reiterate what they just learned in the lecture and cause them to understand how that applies to what they're seeing as they open the daily newspaper. And this is an exciting program, Dr. Stan, because we have people who just average housewives or a businessman who, you know, is concerned for what's happening in the country, saying, I've got to do something. Here's something simple that they can do without having to have a great deal of skill and preparation. They can turn a group of people to understand the foundational principles, understand the Declaration, what it means, understand the Constitution, and understand when things are unconstitutional being done by the federal government or state governments. And so we've offered this host kit, and people can actually purchase it online if they choose to do that. They could go to our website, which is www.iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. Or they can call us toll-free and order a host kit. That toll-free number is 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796.
And I want to just say that certainly the Institute of the Constitution helps bring this program to you, but I believe totally in what they're doing. When I got started in this conservative Christian movement back 43 years ago, there were a lot of programs there to teach people the Constitution, and the people were learning it. But, of course, tremendous pressure was brought to bear to silence this teaching because there are people out there who do not want the American people to understand that their freedom is being stolen from them. And so eventually they were able to silence this effort. Certainly private efforts to teach the Constitution, public efforts, they've certainly taken any education about our Constitution out of our schools. And what is being taught in civics today is how wonderful the United Nations is and how wonderful the United Nations petition of rights, Declaration of Rights is, and how much better that is because you get so many more things guaranteed than you get under the Bill of Rights of the of our Constitution. And they've done everything they can to diseducate our children, and we have so many young people today who are prepared to become citizens of the world in the New World Order. That will have a New World Religion. So when you understand that, you understand really why what David and the people at the Institute of the Constitution are doing, why that is so important. And what's really exciting is that all across the country today, why new classes are starting up, and David travels all over the country to talk to the people. And certainly we know in many of the states why they have a number of these classes going on a regular basis. You're not going to hear about this from Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Lou Dobbs or so many of the people, the establishment people, playing their parts so cleverly, so subtly. But, of course, the truth of the matter is that there is an underground movement, to rekindle that flame of freedom that is just about to be extinguished here. But the important thing is to understand what we're in favor of, and we're in favor of the Constitution. And there are traitors in Washington, D.C. who swore to uphold our Constitution, who are doing everything they can to destroy it. So with that as background, go ahead, David.
And once they had signed the Declaration of Independence, they had actually disestablished all of their colonial governments. They now, instead of having 13 colonies, there were 13 states, but those 13 states each needed a constitution. They returned to their home states, drafted those constitutions, and you'll find in every single one of those constitutions an acknowledgement of God. And by the way, all of the subsequent states, all 50 states in these United States, include an acknowledgement of God that they recognize their government comes from God because our rights come from God. Well, then they came back together as a Congress and they began drafting what are known as the Articles of Confederation. And this was actually approved the following year, 1777, finally ratified by all the states in 1781. It was really more of a compact among the states than a true constitution, however. It spoke very clearly some of the principles that were preserved in the Constitution. For instance, the sovereignty of the states. That these were 13 sovereign nations, in a sense, coming together. As a matter of fact, in my state of Maryland, up until the turn of the 19th century, beginning of the 19th century, people would refer to Maryland as my nation Maryland. And many of the other states had a very similar understanding that the sovereignty of the individual states was clearly understood in the founding era right on up until the war between the states, which destroyed that sense of sovereignty and began imposing a federal tyranny, small at first, but growing to the enormous gargantuan proportions that we see of our day. Well, the purpose of this Articles of Confederation was really a league of friendship between the 13 states for common defense, security of liberty, and mutual welfare. And these three purposes were preserved in the Constitution. They were not changed. There was not a radical alteration, as that history professor wanted to tell me, between the Declaration and the Constitution. And the proof of the pudding is right here in the Articles of Confederation. The purposes of common defense, security of liberty, and mutual welfare are the exact purposes that the Constitution states in its very brief preamble. The rights of citizens while they were in other states was one of the major concerns of the Articles of Confederation, because 13 individual nations in that respect and that attitude, well, when you traveled into a foreign state, you know, across the border from Virginia to, you know, North Carolina or whatever, were you going to have your rights protected? And the Articles of Confederation spoke to those issues and protected those rights. The Articles structured a Congress, but there was no chief executive, there was no president in that sense, nor was there a federal judiciary. And today we might think, you know, that's a pretty good thing. Boy, the federal judiciary is such a mess, we'd be glad not to have it, and the president as well, we'd be glad not to have him. But we need to recognize that that was actually one of the weaknesses of the Articles of Confederation that the Constitution corrected, because they recognized the sinfulness of human hearts means that you cannot entrust power to any one group or one individual. They've seen with one individual like King George, there's tremendous risk for your freedom to be taken and violated if power is entrusted to that one man. The same thing with one group of men, such as Congress. It was a single house of Congress, not a bicameral Congress as we have today with a House and a Senate. And they recognized in forming the Constitution that there was need for checks and balances between the three branches of government, judiciary, the executive, and the legislative branches. So the states, also in the Articles of Confederation, could not themselves make treaties with foreign nations and could not maintain standing armies except as necessary for defense. Again, very important principles. The army was to be limited by these strictures, and the army really was to be under the control of the state as a state militia. And only when there was a national emergency was the state militias federalized, that they were brought to bear together. And that meant the states actually appointed all the military officers in the militia, with the exception of generals. Generals were the only officers at the federal level. Now, the costs for war immediately in front of them, of course, was the War for Independence. Those costs were to be paid out of the treasury of the Confederation of all 13 states. Now, this was one of the problems. The federal government had no taxing power. You might think, that's a great thing. Boy, I wish the federal government had no taxing power. Instead, it only had voluntary requisitions under the Articles of Confederation. That is, Congress would send a letter to the 13 states saying, hey, we have this need here for our military, and would you voluntarily contribute to it? And state legislatures in those days usually did not meet year-round. They would meet for 2, 3, maybe 4 months at the most at one period of time of the year. And so that letter from Congress would arrive and sit for a while before it was ever read. And then, you know, usually the state legislatures would pay all the bills that they had before them. And if there was anything left over, then they might send that a portion of that to Congress. Well, this meant that the Army, during our War for Independence, was woefully under-equipped. They did not have enough basic clothing, like we know in Valley Forge and other incidents. They didn't often have the necessary tools to conduct the war, of gunpowder and bullets and those kind of things. We only won the war by miracles that God brought to pass, and certainly the weaknesses of the Articles of Confederation were very evident during the war. Now, following the war, Alexander Hamilton, who we know had his own agenda, he really wanted to kind of create a monarchy, he was urging for a stronger government and urging for a constitutional convention to be called. nobody paid really any attention to it other than the state of New York. His own state passed a resolution urging a constitutional convention. But Hamilton was able to persuade one man, and that one man was George Washington. He had served under Washington during the war years, was close to him. And Washington, in 1785, wrote a letter to all 13 states urging a constitutional convention. And it gained enough traction that Congress actually called for a trade conference, because there were kind of several different trade disputes going on between the 13 states. And that was called, and they gathered in Annapolis, Maryland, and only five states actually showed up. So it really wasn't a quorum. They really couldn't enact anything. But later, the following year, 1787, Congress called for the Constitutional Convention to be held in Philadelphia. This was called for in May, 1787. And when it was called for, the sole purpose and express purpose was for revising the Articles of Confederation. One of the difficulties, however, is the Articles of Confederation said any amendment to those articles required unanimous consent of all 13 states to make any change. Well, as the convention began, only two states had arrived, so it didn't really begin until the 25th of May. During those days, though, from the 14th of May to the 25th, a very important event took place. James Madison and the others from Virginia sat down and wrote up what are known as the Virginia Resolves. These actually became the basic agenda for the convention and set the tone as the other delegates began to gather by May 25th and begin to work on the issues that ultimately led to the formation of our Constitution. Now, many people who studied this history say there's a problem here, because the Constitutional Convention ultimately stepped back from a unanimous requirement that all 13 states sign on to any changes, and ultimately backed it up to say that only nine states had to ratify the Constitution for it to be in effect. But the real rub of the issue is this. If these are 13 separate nations, 13 separate states, and we understand that they're sovereign, if they did not sign the Constitution, they did not join the Constitution Convention. They did not join in the other states. So the nine states, in essence, that signed the Constitution and ratified it, they became these United States, small u. The other states ultimately all signed on, and Rhode Island was the last holdout, because they realized, wait a minute, we're no longer part of this this country. We're going to be excluded in terms of trade, we're going to be excluded in terms of many other things, and it's to our disadvantage, even though we're not too happy about being part of this, it's to our disadvantage, business-wise and safety-wise, not to join. And so ultimately they all signed, all 13 states signed the Constitution and joined in a sense, in amending the Articles of Confederation by agreeing together that they needed to be changed, and that change was codified in our Constitution. So it's a very interesting piece of history that transpires between here, because it proves what I was arguing that debate with a professor, that there was no radical change between the Declaration and the Constitution. There were some changes that took place as they recognized weakness in the Articles of Confederation, but the basic themes of the Articles of Confederation, the purposes of the Articles, were preserved in the Constitution, and they were strengthened, and they saw that the new form that they were structuring was superior in significant ways while retaining the strength and the beauty of those Articles of Confederation. For example, the sovereignty of the states, very clearly reaffirmed in the Bill of Rights, the Ninth Bill of Rights, Article 9, clearly states that anything not stated in the Constitution as powers granted to the federal government were reserved to the states or to the people themselves. So the federal government had no more power than the powers granted to it by the Constitution.
I think it's really so important that people understand that we talk about separation of powers and legislative, judicial, and executive. Also, there was a separation of powers between the federal government mm-hmm. and the state government. And this is such an important concept, because the power of the federal government was to be limited, and it could not do anything that was not specifically stipulated in the Constitution, and any function that was not given to the federal government was to be reserved to the states and to the people. Now, today, the Department of Education is unconstitutional. Today, so much of what the federal government is doing is totally in violation of the precepts of the Constitution. It's not the function of our federal government to provide for the health care of the people, to provide medication for the people. It's the function of our federal government to guard our borders. They're not doing that. It's the function of the federal government, you know, to have create a sound currency. They're not doing that. They're destroying the value of our currency and stealing really the wealth that people have accumulated through the years simply by the most vicious of all taxes, inflation. So what the federal government should be doing, they're not, and much of what they should not be doing, they are. That's because we've allowed it to happen. That's because the people don't understand our Constitution or the foundations of our freedom.
I had an example of that come to my door just recently here. The Census Bureau is doing a community survey. It's completely unconstitutional. They're granted by the Constitution the power to once every 10 years take a census of the United States. And that census is only to include the enumeration of how many citizens are there in the United States for purposes of how many representatives you're going to have. Well, the Census Bureau now wants to know how many cars you have, how many toilets are in your house, how many this, how many that, how much money do you make? All these things are completely unconstitutional. I refused to answer the guy's question, much to his frustration, and I told him the reason I refused is it's not in the Constitution. He is a federal employee, must abide by the Constitution. That's the supreme law of the land. Most Americans don't know that, and therefore they go along with whatever the federal government suggests they do.
And, of course, when the government fears the people, there's freedom. But when the people fear the government, there's tyranny. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program with Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. Well, David, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
One of the things I hope your listeners will grasp, a simple explanation that they can explain to even a grade school student, that the purpose of government is clearly stated in the Declaration. We have a Creator God who has given us our rights, and that government's sole purpose is to protect and defend our God-given rights. That's what the Declaration said. That's the why. The philosophy of government. That's the foundation. That's the preamble, so to speak. The how is how it was worked out in details, first in the Articles of Confederation, and then as it was changed into the Constitution. But what needs to be understood and remembered is that both the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution were designed to restrict and limit the federal government. Say, the federal government has power to do this. We, the people, have granted the federal government power to do this, and not do this, to do this and not do this, a whole list of things they can do and a list of things they cannot and must not do. And most people have lost that concept that the federal government is supposed to be a limited government, given powers that are limited, enumerated, and they have no more powers than those powers specifically given to them by we the people. That we the people are the masters of our government, we're not the servants of our government. And we have given them these powers, for instance, the census power, and the power is once every 10 years, not in the middle of a decade, which is what the Census Bureau is doing right now, and only to gather numbers on how many citizens for purposes of representation and taxation, for no other reason. And they're out there gathering information for building the New World Order, as best I can conclude. And unless we the people will return to limiting our federal government and forcing it to stay within the boundaries set by the Constitution, we're going to continue to lose our liberties in this land. So I would encourage your listeners to get a host kit and host an institute on the Constitution in their home, especially in their church, in their community. They can call us toll-free to order a host kit at 866-730-9796. Let me repeat that toll-free number, 866-730-9796, or they can go to the web, iotconline.com.
And let me just commend this movement to you. This is so vitally important. If you really value your freedom, if you are concerned about the freedom of your children, your grandchildren, learn about the Constitution yourself, and then, of course, teach them, then teach others. This is a growing movement. The people must understand the foundation of our freedom if we hope to preserve it. Good night, David. Thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure. And our guest has been Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do, 5 hours every day. As we reach out across America on about 60 outlets every week, some of them are every day, some of them are only once a week, but at least we're reaching people and bringing them the news behind the news, the story behind the story. If you'd like to reach my ministry, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, if you'd like to understand the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged, let me suggest that you call that 800 number, 1-800-544-8927, and ask for a copy of The Occult Hierarchy. Now, The Occult Hierarchy, most people are totally unaware of. You can go up on the Internet, and you can Google in, don't go to AOL Google site, but go to the original www.google.com, and pull down The Occult Hierarchy, and you'll find things written there by people who are part of the occult hierarchy, who will tell you about the masters of wisdom, the ancients of days, the certainly the Great White Brotherhood. There really are these groups that are out there. You've never heard of them. Of course you're not going to, because you're not going to learn about this from so many of our leaders today. But there is another dimension. We of course, watch many of our television programs about mediums, and of course, they're in contact with the other dimension. If you read the scriptures, you're told you should avoid having anything to having to do with divination or sorcerers or witchcraft or mediums, because they're in contact with the other dimension. Well, there is another dimension out there, and that is where the occult hierarchy dwells and where they come from. And if you'd like a free copy of my newsletter on the occult hierarchy, Part 2, why, you can find it at our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's our June newsletter. But if you'd like a free copy, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Ask for a copy of the Occult Hierarchy, Part 2. We'll be glad to send it to you free of charge. And then, of course, we hope that you'll go to our website where you can listen to our programs 3 hours a day directly. You can go to our archive programs and pull them down. You can listen to the programs we do on other networks, the American Freedom Network and Genesis Network, and you can listen to those live. There will be links there that will take you to the other networks or tell you how to reach them. And then, of course, we want to remind you, we are having an all-day seminar in the Monterey Bay area, where I live in the North Shore of Monterey Bay. It's going to be on the 19th of November, an all-day seminar, and if you're thinking about coming, well, you're going to have to give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, because we're serving lunch. We have to know how many people are going to come. And then we remind you we're involved in a spiritual battle being carried out here in America and throughout the world for the souls of men and the preservation of Western civilization. So please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision, and our protection. And so until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. The views of our guests and the views of our callers, please don't call in unless we do ask for calls a little later, and we'll give the telephone number if we do. But before I introduce Arthur Burncloud, I want to read you a poem, one of my favorite. There's a graveyard near the White House where the unknown soldier lies, and the flowers there are sprinkled with the tears from mother's eyes. I stood there not so long ago with roses for the brave, and suddenly I heard a voice speak from out the grave. "I am the unknown soldier," the spirit voice began, "and I think I have the right to ask some questions, man to man. Are my buddies being taken care of? Was their victory so sweet as that big reward you offered selling pencils on the street? Did they really win the freedom they battled to achieve? Do you still respect the Croix de Guerre above the empty sleeve? Does a gold star in the window now mean anything at all? I wonder how my old girl feels when she hears a bugle call. And that baby who sang, 'Hello, Central, give me no man's land,' can they really replace her daddy with a military band? I wonder if the profiteers have satisfied their greed. I wonder if a soldier's mother ever is in need. I wonder if the kings who planned it all are really satisfied. They played their game of checkers, and 11 million died. I am the unknown soldier, and maybe I died in vain. But if I were alive and my country called, I'd do it all over again." That was, of course, written after World War I, when there was a gold star in the window, when 11 million men, soldiers died, another 10 million civilians died. It was a terrible, terrible bloody war. And the question was, what was really all about? Well, those of you who, of course, read my treatise on Iraq, The Untold Story, or seen our video, understand that the wars are all contrived, as is the current war we're involved in. But that doesn't detract from the heroism of the men who fight on the war. And we have many, many brave soldiers who've committed themselves to defend our country and have sacrificed their lives in that calling. Well, with us this evening is Arthur Burncloud of Veterans for Constitutional Law, who is really an advocate for the veterans who are caught up in a system. Oh, the politicians are so in favor of our men. Oh, we're solidly behind our men, until, of course, they come home wrecked many times, crippled, psychological problems, beset with disease, and then, of course, they are simply transferred to the Veterans Administration, which is supposed to look after them and really doesn't, because there's not enough money to do it, and because the politicians really don't care. They're going to say what's going to get them votes, but they could care very little about the men who are courageous enough to fight for our country, because most of the politicians, right up into the very White House itself, would never think about going to the war and risking their own lives. Now, there are a few. There are a few that we certainly respect in the legislature who have fought for our country, but so many of them, and including people in the current administration, were always, of course, able to find an excuse to send somebody else's son off to bleed and fight and suffer and die, but not themselves. And with that as a background, we're going to introduce our special guest this evening, Mr. Arthur Burncloud of Veterans for Constitutional Law. Go ahead, Arthur. Tell
Dr. Stan, it's always a pleasure to do a program with you. Always.
Well, let's go right ahead and tell us what's happening as far as the veterans are concerned.
Okay. First of all, we have a book here, a new book on Vietnam that you might not be aware of. I don't know if your stores out there on the West Coast are carrying it, but they just started carrying it here on the East Coast. And it's by a combat Vietnam veteran by the name of Tyrone T. Dancy. And the book's name is Serving Under Adverse Conditions, published by an outfit by the name of Author House in Bloomington, Indiana. And Tyrone Dancy has a style of writing that's so unique. I haven't run across this, but this is one of the two books on Vietnam I've read this year. This one and one by a gentleman I met through you, Dave Tedeschini. And it's a wonderful book here. And just to give you an idea, he's got an epilogue ending the book here. And that's quite touching, too, like the poem you just read. By the way, that was supposed to be the war to end all wars, World War One.
Yeah, but it was fought to make the world safe for democracy. And it almost looks like we're reading the same script today. We're over in the Middle East. We want to bring democracy. Yet we fought the war to end all wars, to bring democracy to the world, to make the world safer democracy. That was the reason our boys went to France in 1917 to fight and bleed and suffer and die. That was the slogan. They just love these slogans to justify the brutality and the horror of war.
Well, history is just doomed to keep repeating itself, and it does. This is the epilogue, and it's called America, America, Remember Me by Tyrone Dancy. Remember me, I was there when you called, when you needed me to bear arms and fight in behalf of this country. I was there in the freezing cold and the scorching heat. I slept in the rain and crawled through mud, mud that was spattered with my blood. America, America, remember me. I was among the wounded evacuated from the battlefield. Gallons of blood were wasted that day, as dozens of bodies lay under the scorching sun. The smell of flesh and blood possessed the air. America, America, remember me. I was closer to death than alive as the helicopter left the bloody ground behind. I felt proud, then pain, then trepidation. I exemplified America's finest tradition. I had gone forward into battle, subject to lose limbs or life for America. America, America, remember me.
Hold that thought, Arthur. We're going to have to bring our other stations right on back right now.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Arthur is reading from the epilogue to a book on Vietnam. That, do you want to pick up the story there, Arthur?
Oh, absolutely. America, America, remember me. Now that I have survived bearing scars and suffering severe injuries, America, you seem to have difficulty recognizing me. When you sent me to war, I had no scars or physical damage, physical or emotional difficulties. America, America, remember me. I was there when you called. I served dutifully, bravely, and honorably. Why am I not in your memory? America, America, remember me. Tyrone Dancy was hit in a firefight, no less than 15 wounds. And it's amazing that he has survived. And all this happened 35 years ago. In a country that, before we went there, nobody even heard of Vietnam, and we went there and we gave up 58,000 lives. And
we lost 58,000 men. Nobody ever talks about the 1 million South Vietnamese who died, or the 2 million North Vietnamese that died, and yet every one of them was a unique individual made in the image and likeness of God. But isn't it amazing how they can focus our attention on our losses? And,
yeah.
And I feel terrible about those losses. But you have to understand that had we not gone over there, this war would have certainly not been drawn on for a long period of time, and we never went to Vietnam to win that war. We could have won it at any time. I was told that by the American ambassador, Mr. William H. Sullivan, who I interviewed, by General Lew Walt, a four-star Marine general. We could have won it in 2 months. We didn't go there to win that war.
No, we didn't.
There was a great diversion as they changed America. And the Supreme Court took away our freedom, centralized all power in Washington, D.C., found a woman had a constitutional right to abortion and to kill the child within her. We took God and prayer out of our schools during that time. They knew exactly what they were doing, but they could never let the American people realize it was a grand diversion. And that's what wars are so often. They take our attention off the loss of freedom here at home. And as our men go overseas to fight for freedom, we lose our freedom here.
You know, when people there used to say, "What's this war all about?" And I used to say, fly along the coastline and take a look at those oil rigs going day and night, and that'll tell you what this war is all about. We were drilling offshore oil there. That's another country that we were trying to grab oil out of.
Well, I think it's so interesting. You talk about the veterans, the people who came back from Vietnam with their injuries. But what people are not being told here in America is that the young men are coming home from Iraq today and from Afghanistan. Even the Veterans Administration, the administration will admit that a third, 30% of these young men who are coming home without any physical wounds within 2 to 3 months, they have serious illness. Now, they call it mental illness of some sort. Perhaps some of it is mental illness. Perhaps some of it is post-traumatic stress. But perhaps it is very similar to what happened to so many of the people who came home after the first Gulf War. And they came down ill. And, of course, they wanted to call it the Gulf War syndrome, but the government didn't want that. They did not want to admit they'd used experimental vaccines on our, or maybe intentionally used experimental vaccines on our men. And about somewhere between approximately 50% of those people are ill today, have Gulf War illness, and the government denies it exists. We do have a government report from the Veterans Administration that admit that it does exist, but you know, here it's like deja vu all over again. 30% within 2 to 3 months of coming home, physically intact, but something seriously wrong with them. And believe me, the government's doing everything they can to conceal the truth from the American people and from the veterans.
You bet they are. Well, many returning United States troops do face lifelong health problems. This is a report that came out of AFP in Paris. United States combat troops, traumatized by their experiences in Iraq, may suffer long-term damage to their physical health, as well as known risks to their mental well-being. This is out of a British magazine called New Scientist. Veterans will be paying the price of combat for decades to come, it says in its next issue, which is going to be out. It's already out, the issue. Doctors are already familiar with psychological impact of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which is the modern name for shell shock, and that's a term that was coined in World War I. And people with PTSD can suffer from grim flashbacks, wild mood swings, bouts of depression, insomnia, and anxiety, and they're prone to drug and alcohol abuse and likelier to die of accidents, overdoses, and suicide. But evidence is also emerging now of a link between PTSD and physical disease, and the symptoms may emerge years after trauma, New Scientist says. Soon to be published research by New York Academy of Medicine epidemiologist Joseph Boscarino found stark differences in physical health among veterans with PTSD as a result of combat and those with non-combat PTSD. Boscarino revisited a U.S. Centers for Disease Control, CDC, study into the long-term health of 18,000 Vietnam veterans. He was surprised to discover that those with combat PTSD were much likelier to die from heart disease and cancer than those with non-combat PTSD. The big difference cannot be explained by differences in smoking habits, and Boscarino suspects that the blame may lie with high levels of stress hormones, which disrupt the immune system. This last March, Tel Aviv University researchers published a study which revealed that among Israeli veterans of fighting in Lebanon in 1982, those with PTSD were now twice as likely to have high blood pressure, ulcers, and diabetes, and five times likelier to have heart disease and headaches when compared with non-PTSD counterparts. United States Army doctors writing in the New England Journal of Medicine in July concluded that more than 17% of U.S. veterans from Iraq could be affected by PTSD, a rate that translates to around 60,000 people so far. That figure has been drastically changed the last few months to closer to 30%. 30% seems to be a more accurate figure. The more firefights Iraq veterans experienced, the likelier they were to have PTSD, they found. The figure to Iraq was similar with that of Vietnam veterans. They had 15% in Vietnam who experienced similar close combat stresses of roadside bombs, ambushes, and guerrilla attacks, and witnessing death and injuries to colleagues and civilians. Now, in contrast, the PTSD rate among U.S. veterans of the first Gulf War was put at between 2 and 10%. Rates of PTSD among the general U.S. population are estimated at 3 to 4%, the U.S. Army doctors say. And I think that figure is all wet. But this is coming out of a New Scientist, and that's the report we got here.
All right, well, Chris, I think that they're ignoring a lot of this. I think that there are people, certainly we know, who are seriously injured by the experimental vaccines in the first Gulf War. And, of course, they've continued using these experimental vaccines, specifically the anthrax vaccine, with no justification at all, I think just to see what was going to happen. And now we have superimposed upon that the effect of the depleted uranium. And then we have the psychological impact on these young people. So, you know, many of these people will never be the same again. They may come back without a wound. Of course, they may also come back with an arm or a leg or missing or blinded. And, of course, the number of casualties is tremendous. And we're not hearing at all about that. All they talk about are the number killed in combat, and they separate the number killed in Iraq from the number killed in Afghanistan, just to confuse the public. And they never talk about the people who die in Wiesbaden, because they get them onto their planes as soon as they can, then they get them out of Iraq. So they will not have died in Iraq. They die over in Germany. We have no idea how many casualties there are. I know that some of the people who are very, very good observers on this believe that we may have twice as many casualties as the government is telling us, because they don't want the American people to know the truth. But, you know, then the number of casualties and the people who, you know, have serious injuries that will be with them the rest of their life. What sort of support are they getting now from the Veterans Administration, Arthur?
Practically none. Practically none. They still haven't appropriated the money between the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration for more counselors for PTSD people coming back. They're still avoiding treating people on for the Gulf sickness. They're still saying it's a syndrome. They're not pinpointing these things. There's a lot of sick people out there, Dr. Stan.
And of course, the thing is that there's only so much money now. We're going to put a couple hundred billion dollars into rebuilding the Gulf area and helping the casinos get the, and even these fabulously wealthy casinos, they're going to get their share of the government money. They're giving a sweetheart contracts to Halliburton and all the friends of the current administration.
Well, they're rebuilding Guantanamo prison at the cost of $30 million, and that contract went to KBR, which is a division of Halliburton.
In fact, they put out $250 million for luxury cruise liners. And, of course, that was with full components. They were going to be there for 6 months to give housing to the people. And the ships are half empty, and they're just bobbing up and down there in the Mississippi River for $250 million, $250 million. Basically, they just sort of hurried up with these contracts. They could hardly wait to give away money to their friends. But then, of course, they don't have the money for the veterans. And now, of course, we've got to come up with money for all these other things, for the Medicare situation, and for, you know, for all the federal control of education. But there's no money there for the veterans.
No.
We'll be back in just a moment here with Arthur Birnbaum, talking about the plight of American veterans. And a little later, we're going to tell you how to get hold of Arthur, who really represents the veterans. He's a veterans advocate in a totally corrupt VA system that is intent upon one thing, not taking care of the veterans, but of course withholding care and treatment and withholding the disability benefits. Last thing I heard, there were 300,000 veterans waiting to have their cases heard before the Veterans Administration paid to look after our heroes.
I think the figure's around 340,000.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Arthur, you were saying, what are the figures? How many people are there waiting to get hearing?
About 340,000.
340,000. So you can see what good care they're taking of our people. Now, what do the people do in the meantime for income?
Well, in the meantime, some of them have Social Security. The ones who don't have Social Security are out on the street.
Well, this is a rather sad commentary. And, of course, once they are thrown out of the military or discharged from the military, then they come under the kind care of the Veterans Administration. And actually, my understanding is that in certain circumstances, VA officials are paid bonuses not to give benefits to the veterans. Is that really true?
Well, that's the crux of the whole thing. This has been going on for over 70 years. What they do is they pay themselves bonuses to deny claims. They find any excuse in the world to deny claims, and they don't even have to have an excuse. They've been denying claims like this for 70 years. And bonuses are paid to rating board members, to lawyers, to administrators. And there's more and more veterans who are being done out of their benefits, incredibly done out of their benefits. They did a write-up on this in the Knight Ridder newspapers. I think about 30-some-odd newspapers covered this. And they had old-timers here, like this fellow Arco Ciancanelli in Chicago, who was done out of his benefits since 1945. And the man was never paid until the Chicago Sun-Times put him on the front page of the paper with his picture. And 8 days later, he receives a check from the Veterans Administration for $18,144. And he made the front page again. And he said if the paper had not written his story, he would have never gotten a cent from the Veterans Administration. And he put in for the rest of his disability that they've owed him for 60 years, actually, since 1945. But on May 29th, he dies. And I've been trying to get the money for the family of Arco Ciancanelli. And the secretary of the VA, his office says, we're not going to pay him one button. And I said, pray tell, why is that? And they said, he's dead. We don't have to. That's the law. And I point out to him, that's not the law. That's a VA regulation. And there was a case in the Supreme Court, the Gardner case, and it said VA regulations do not supersede the law. And when I told this to a fellow there at the secretary's office, Mr. Hearn, he said, what are you, some kind of a wise guy? What's your claim number? And I told him, I'll give you my claim number, and then Monday I'll be into Federal District Court in Brooklyn, and I will take out RICO charges on you, and you don't have sovereign immunity. You're only one of the hired help. So at that point, he mellowed out, and he says, well, tell the family of Arco Ciancanelli to file another claim and then get to the back of the line for another 2.5 years. Now, he's been waiting 60 years to get his money, and he died. And another case just happened this last week that I heard about, a veteran who I've been helping right along up in Maine, and I think he's been a caller to your show, too. Name is Phil Castoro from Maine. He finally got an adjudication from the Board of Veterans Appeals. Now, here's another man who was discharged in 1945 with a psychiatric disability. They discharged him. And in 1950, they didn't even have to have a reason. They just took it away from him.
Hold
and
that right there, Arthur. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Arthur's been talking about some of these veterans. One that had a disability payment going, claim going back to 1945, and they just weren't going to pay him. And, you know, certainly before his death, a few months or so before his death, why, they did give him $18,000, but he had a claim going back to 1945. And, of course, there's no way that the Veterans Administration is going to give any money to his family, the money that should have been paid out over this last 60 years. And now there are other people that are in exactly the same sort of a situation. The purpose of the Veterans Administration is not to take care of the veterans. The purpose of the Veterans Administration is to make people think that we're taking care of the veterans, but the truth is they are expendable. As they were expendable in battle, so they're expendable when they come home. But we can't tell the people in the military that, because if they realize they were going to be betrayed by their own country, many of them might not want to go off and risk their lives to make the world safe for democracy, to fight the war to end all wars.
Well, this fellow, Philip Castoro, he got an adjudication on August 17th from the Board of Veterans' Appeals, and they gave him a 70% disability. Finally, after all these years. Now, don't forget, they took his disability away from him in 1950, and he has been fighting them now for 55 years. So now they just gave him the disability, and he called me up, and he said, I got it August the 17th, and they have not sent me my money yet. They promised they would get it to me within a month. Now, this gentleman, he's a fellow in his 80s, very frail. He's got a bad heart condition. He's popping nitro pills like candy, and he's worried that he's going to expire, and if he expires, nobody will get the money. They won't pay the family or anything. He's worried about it, so I started making calls around in Washington. I finally got to Senator Patty Murray's office from Washington State, and she's in on this. He said the other two senators we have up in Maine are totally worthless. So we got Senator Patty Murray in on this thing, and we do a little investigating, and we find out the VA is purposely withholding the money from paying this man because his lawyer and the lawyer he had before, who I advised him to fire, I advised him to fire the lawyer he had before. He was worthless, and the current lawyer he got belongs to the same organization as the other lawyer, and the two of them are squabbling over the their cut on his disability. And I told Patty Murray's office today, look, the man is sick. He may not survive. The chances are against him surviving. Get him his money. To hell with these two lawyers. You want to withhold the lawyer's fees and let the two lawyers squabble and fight it out? Fine, but get this man his money. Now, the VA, they don't need an excuse to withhold the money from the veteran. If they can withhold the veteran's money, they're as happy as pigs and you know what. And this is the way the VA works. And most of these fellas, I'd say 99% of these fellas who are serving overseas in combat areas, people who are laying their lives on the line, they're not aware of what they're going to run into when they have to face the VA and denials of claims. It's incredible. Now, I've got a letter here from a fellow who's overseas, who's with the Arizona Army National Guard, Leonard Clark, 860 MP Company. He says he doesn't mind me mentioning his name. And it says here, I've been talking to my fellow soldiers about this whole situation, and I've told them about how the leadership in Washington is trying to get the American people to silence their criticism of the continued lunacy we call the occupation of Iraq. I tell them that they're saying to the Congress, well, you know, our poor soldiers want to stay and finish the fight in Iraq, but you people in Washington, D.C., are undercutting their morale by bringing up this timetable stuff, and what the hell are we doing in Iraq? Do we have a plan? When I tell this to my fellow soldiers, they immediately begin to laugh, and then they get annoyed that such BS is being sprouted back home, because we're the ones who are calling home and telling our families what a bunch of lies and crap they're telling the American people.
You know, I think that language is really a little inappropriate for a Christian in the station, please.
Okay.
Even though he may have written this thing, I would really appreciate
it. I'll tone that down.
I'd really tone that down.
There are, to be sure, some soldiers, fewer and fewer day by day, who are naively still blindly believing the lies. In fact, if they could have been around in 1968, they would have fit in real well, if you know what I mean. Now, what do you mean we should stay in Vietnam? We're going to win this thing. We're killing 50 to 100 of those Viet Cong, and they're only killing three of us. And then the next question to them would be, well, what about all the American soldiers who are going to die for this so-called police action in Vietnam? And their response was, well, it's for democracy. If it takes more American soldiers to die, well, then so be it.
Well, I think the great tragedy is we're in an impossible situation. We never should have gone in. We were taken in on a basis of faulty information, frank lies, and people are dying. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Walter Bernclough, and Walter is certainly talking about the plight of our gentlemen, our people that we have serving over in Iraq today, and certainly serving in Afghanistan. These are the men who are in harm's way, but remember, we're still occupying Germany 60 years after the war ended, and still occupying Korea 50 years after the war ended, still occupying Japan 60 years after the war ended, and nobody ever asked, why are we occupying Japan? Gee, I thought that the communism was dead. Why do we have occupation forces in Europe and in Japan and in Korea and in 130 nations throughout the world? And why do we have troops in so many of the countries there in the Middle East besides Afghanistan? And certainly we're doing everything we can right now to surround Iran militarily. As many people think we're preparing for another war over there. So pick up the story there, Arthur.
Well, the answer to your question, Dr. Stan, is we're pursuing an imperialistic, a mad imperialistic dream. That's why we've got the troops over there when they're not needed. Now, the next question to them, I told some fellow soldiers who still follow blindly and being spoon-fed to them about the Vietnam scenario, and their response was, Vietnam and Iraq are not alike. It's like comparing apples and oranges because Vietnam's communists were well-funded and supplied by the Chinese. Then I asked them about the report from the CIA that was in the press, which stated the terrorists are well-funded, and they just ignored what I said. You know what, fellow activists? 5 or 10 years from now, we're going to be debating these same people after 5 to 10,000 American soldiers are killed, only to see another undemocratic, theocratic church state, probably led by another dictator of our choosing, ruling Iraq. Now, was it worth it? And they'll probably say, gee, you know what, maybe it wasn't worth it, maybe we should have kicked Saddam Hussein out and then left Iraq and let the Iraqi government we set up run their own country. But instead, we just stayed on and on and on, and the American soldiers continued to die on and on and on, and the funerals and the mother and fatherless children continued on and on and on. Well, will we have another war for Iraq like we did for Vietnam? You see, federal three-piece suited politicians are really not different from city politicians. They'll wait until enough people die before they put in a stoplight at the local intersection in their city. To them, one life is not worth the $100,000 for a stoplight. But, yeah, maybe 8 to 10 lives when the voters start to notice. So it doesn't matter to them if the right thing would be to put in a stoplight, and it doesn't matter
if
people...
Well, that's off right there. We're going to have to bring our stations back on. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Arthur Bernclough. Arthur, would you like to get your telephone number and your website out, or help people can get in touch with Veterans for Constitutional Law?
I'm glad you asked me, because this is the one thing I keep forgetting on my programs. We're Veterans for Constitutional Law, and we help veterans try to get the benefits that's due to them. None of us are making any money at this. We are paid $1 a year, and we're made up of veterans, disabled veterans, and military retirees. And we're located at, we're Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited. We're located at 112 Jefferson Avenue, 112 Jefferson Avenue in Port Jefferson, New York, 11777. 112 Jefferson Avenue, Port Jefferson, New York, 11777. We're very easily accessible to telephone calls. Our number is 631-474-4261. That's 631-474-4261. If you're having problems with the VA, with your claim, with your adjudication, any other problems, we'd like to hear about it, and we might be able to help you. We've helped an awful lot of veterans.
You spend a lot of time really working with the veterans, and when they get into the administrative process, it's rather frightening and intimidating. They don't know how to handle it. They're not allowed to have lawyers during the initial phase of this, whereas the other side has all sorts of lawyers. So they really need somebody to help them. Many of the Veterans Administration, many of the Veterans Organizations, the American Legion and Veterans of Foreign Wars. And so many of the Veterans Administrations have actually been co-opted and taken over by the Veterans Administration. In other words, they provide for them. They give them all sorts of gifts. So the Veterans Organizations will not stand up for the veterans. And that's why you need an independent organization and why we have Arthur on from time to time, so that our listeners out there, if you either are a veteran or you have a veteran in your family or you know of a veteran who's getting the cold shoulder, as it were, or the runaround from the Veterans Administration bureaucracy, why Arthur is there to help. So go ahead, Arthur.
Well, you see, they have something called a charter, the Veterans Administration, and there's 112 veterans organizations in this country, and there's 46 of them that are chartered. Now, the chartered ones get freebies. In other words, they get free rent in VA buildings, all their furniture and computer equipment, free telephone, free postage, free stationery, a staff to run the office, and, of course, you know, a tax-exempt status. And we've been offered the charter, and we said we're not interested in the charter. We're not interested in the freebies. We don't want to give up our independence. We are not going to become a satellite of the VA like the others have become. And it's amazing. Just this week we had another veterans organization change and turn over into a veterans a VA satellite, an organization we've been working together with for the last 9 years, 9.5 years. Anyway, back to the stoplight. It doesn't matter to them if the right thing would be to put in a stoplight, and it doesn't matter if people beg these politicians for the safety of their children to put stoplights in, because decency and compassion will not get them elected. Only money and votes will. And we all know these hypocrites value money more than they do human life. Well, this fellow in Iraq says, well, I'm not going to wait for another wall for Iraq to be filled with the names of my fellow soldiers, and I hope you're not either. The cause we fight for is noble and just. It is to save the lives of American soldiers who are tragically dying over here needlessly. If we can just save one more American soldier's life, who knows, we might end up saving humanity itself. And there are those who say that one life is not worth much, but I say every human life is the gift of God. And to destroy one of these lives for the greed and corruption of hypocrites who do not have to fight wars, nor whose children do not have to fight wars, is a great sin. To lie and say we're dying over here to ensure democracy in the Middle East, when what we're really doing is fighting for Exxon and Halliburton, is impeachable. Remember this. Not one more American soldier should die over here, for it is a needless death that didn't have to happen, but only for the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And one last note. Today, after my three-vehicle patrol passed through a certain stretch of highway, an hour to 2 hours later, another patrol was hit by a bomb on that same stretch. Another American soldier was killed, and at least three of his comrades were wounded. Hopefully, they will all live. Not one more American soldier. No mas. Please pray for us soldiers, and we will pray for you, and the peace of God will see us through. And this was written by Leonard Clark, who's he calls himself a damn liberal serving in Iraq. He's a National Guard soldier serving and patrolling the mean streets of Iraq every day. And his civilian occupation was, he was a kindergarten teacher, inner city school, public schools, and he was a candidate for the United States Senate in Arizona against John Kyle. Now I'll vote for him.
Well, I would think that the biggest thing that people have to understand is that the National Guard, its purpose, the National Guard, is to defend our nation, not to
exactly be
involved in imperialistic wars. If they certainly want to fight a war, why don't they bring the troops from Germany? Why don't they bring the troops from Japan and from Korea? Why, we can't do that. We've got to occupy those countries. After all, why they might be attacked by the Russians or by the Chinese, or we have to have our troops stationed throughout the world. We do not have to have our troops stationed throughout the world. You know, we should not be taking National Guard troops that are needed here in the United States in case of either a national disaster or, civil unrest or whatever it might be. The purpose of the National Guard is to defend our nation, and I believe it is criminal activity to take them off into a war that was launched under totally false pretenses, under the name of the fact that Saddam Hussein was a menace, was a threat to America, and if any of our leaders have read the book, A See No Evil, written by Robert Baer, who was actually a CIA operative in Iraq in 1995, he will tell you the Iraqi government repeatedly tried to overthrow, the Iraqi military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and our State Department every time betrayed the Iraqi officers who wanted, of course, to get rid of Saddam Hussein, almost as if we were looking for an excuse so we could attack him.
Well,
because
our people
there,
says you can't
how could we justify attacking?
Well, our people there said to them, you can't get rid of him, he's one of us. And he was one of us.
I think that the, I hope our listeners want to get that book by Robert Baer called See No Evil. It's a very, very important book written by a CIA operative. And time and again, at least on two occasions that he speaks of in the book, the military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and the U.S. State Department wouldn't allow it to happen. How could they have been so naive? And if that was true, why didn't we just wait a little longer and give the support to the dissidents who wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein? But you see, that was not the plan. The plan was we're going to have our troops stationed there permanently. And when we went in, instead of course, maintaining the Iraqi army and maintaining the Iraqi peace force, police force, and maintaining the Iraqi civil service, we disbanded all of them, created chaos, and then we wonder why there's chaos. Go ahead, Arthur.
Exactly. Now, do you get a magazine called the Executive Intelligence Review?
No, I don't.
Oh,
that's put out by Lyndon LaRouche, and I. Lyndon LaRouche has a lot of very interesting information, but he also has disinformation because nobody ever asked who funds Lyndon LaRouche. Go ahead.
Well, there was an article there, September 23rd issue, called Cheney's Wars and the Great Energy Price Heist of 2005. I'll shorten this considerably. Richard Freeman is the fellow who wrote this, and the tables referenced in the article are available to subscribers of Executive Intelligence Review. Financier-dominated Sinecura's forces behind Dick Cheney are seizing upon Hurricane Katrina to manufacture a non-existent oil shortage and ratchet up the price of oil through $70 a barrel, headed in the direction of $125 a barrel. This giant swindle is looting populations and transferring the loot to the swelling profits of the oil cartel companies and the banks, using such theft to attempt to postpone the implosion of the bankrupt financial system. Some $30 to $40 of the nearly $70 charged per barrel of petroleum represents pure speculative loot. An American intelligence official told EIR on September 6th that soon after Hurricane Katrina struck, the Bush-Cheney administration was told by Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other oil-producing countries that they had spare refinery capacity. Saudi Arabia and Kuwait offered to deliver gasoline and other refined petroleum products to the United States to offset the temporary shutdown of some Louisiana and U.S. Gulf State refineries and thereby drive down prices. The source said that the Cheney-led White House turned down the offers knowing that they could disrupt the oil cartel's mechanism for price gouging. Instead, between August 29th, the date that Katrina made landfall, and September 9th, Cheney's friends in the cartel rigged gasoline prices, sending them soaring by 50%. Profits poured into the oil companies.
Well, I think it should be very obvious to anybody
Incredible.
Who thinks about this at all. That, you know, if there was a temporary shortage of oil, we have 700 million barrels of oil stored in the strategic reserves, and all they had to do was take out, you know, 50 or 100 million barrels of oil, and there wouldn't have been a shortage, and there wouldn't have been a justification for raising the prices. And the same thing is true as far as heating oil is concerned. They have strategic reserves for that, and they're not using them to justify raising the prices, exactly as Arthur is saying. But is there anything else you wanted to say about the veterans? Because this is really my concern, is the way the veterans are being treated by the Veterans Administration. I am very concerned that these young men who went overseas to fight for America, who believed in America, are not being well treated. Certainly, there's no question that there are forces within our country who have a different agenda and are really more interested in power and power politics. But what about the veterans?
The veterans have been forgotten. They've been forgotten by everybody. an administration here. It's a predatory administrative agency that here they're in charge of doling out the benefits to veterans who are injured, and they are not doing the job that they should be doing to help the veterans, but they're helping themselves to a lot of extra big bucks.
Now, what about the situation where there were a number of people who had Gulf War illness who were told they'd not get any Veterans Administration benefits unless they accepted a post-traumatic stress diagnosis? And they got that post-traumatic stress diagnosis, and they got at least some compensation from the VA to help themselves and their families. And now the VA is going after, what is it, over 100,000
right.
of them to take away their post-traumatic stress rating?
Yes, this is called a big cover-up, Dr. Stan. They wanted to cover up the Gulf sickness. They wanted to cover up that. They wanted to cover up depleted uranium. So they made it easy to get a PTSD disability. A lot of people were given PTSD disabilities who are suffering from the Gulf sickness because they were trying to hide this. Now, Mr. Principi, who resigned under fire the end of last year.
Now, Mr. Principi was the VA administrator?
That's correct. All he right, was the right. secretary of the VA, and he resigned under fire. Since the year 2000, he has known about this, and he covered it up for over 4 years. And finally, when the reports came in from the scientists in Europe, like Dr. Murray and Dr. Karenyi Bhatt and others, the cat was out of the bag, and Mr. Principi had to resign under very heavy fire. But him and the whole Bush administration has hidden. They've actually hidden this thing about the Gulf sickness and depleted uranium, and they made it very easy for people to get PTSD disabilities, knowing that somewhere down the line, 5 years or so, they can knock them off. Because when they ask to produce a stressor, most of these people cannot produce a stressor to prove you've got a PTSD.
Now, what do you mean by a stressor?
A stressor means the thing that caused the PTSD, like a firefight, seeing a close friend or somebody that you've served with blown apart in combat.
So basically what they did then is they gave them a disability based upon something that they knew wasn't true, but it was a matter of either take a post-traumatic stress of rating or nothing, and of course
exactly.
these people were ill because of the Gulf War illness. And for those
exactly,
of you,
and now they're on a witch hunt to try to knock these guys off, and you might say it's the VA's retaliation for what happened in Chicago, when they were forced to give concessions to the Chicago veterans due to the media's corruption expose of the VA Chicago office.
And basically there was a series of articles in what was the Knight Ritter papers that exposed
the Chicago Sun-Times
right.
and the Chicago Tribune.
Right. And so then, of course, it's Arthur's contention that the VA is now going after these people with a post-traumatic stress diagnosis who are victims of the Gulf War. How many of them are out there that they want to reassess?
Well, they've earmarked 79,000. They said 72, but the actual figure is 79,000, and they've also earmarked 68,000 total TDIU, total disability individual unemployability. In other words, people who have 70, 80, 90% disability, not the 100%, but they can't work anymore. They're totally unemployable.
Now, are these from the Vietnam War or are these from the Gulf War?
Both.
All right.
Both. Now, they said they were only going after people who had their adjudications done between 1999 and 2004. That's what the VA claimed. But already there's been a number of Vietnam veterans and even some Korean veterans who have had their disabilities discontinued or cut. Now, I have been broadcasting on almost every station about this, and basically, they cannot do this without having both a hearing and a physical examination. And I'm telling veterans, if they get that letter cutting their disabilities or cutting them out entirely or even downgrading them, to take them into a civil court, a state court, or a federal court on due process violations, because your due process is being violated unless you get both a hearing and a physical examination. Now, if you take them in on due process, you don't have to be under the stringent rules of United States Code Title 38 that govern the disability laws. If you take them in on your disability and you go into a federal court or a state court or any other court, they're going to take that case and remand it back to the Veterans Court. And every veteran knows he's got two chances in a veterans court, slim and none.
All right, well, let's get your telephone number and your website out just one more time in case there are veterans out there who would like to get help from Veterans for Constitutional Law. Let's get the telephone number and the website, or at least your address.
Okay, and then I'll have some good news for you, Dr. Stan. I'm Arthur Bernklau. I'm Executive Director of Veterans for Constitutional Law. We help veterans. We help veterans who are having problems with the VA. We help veterans who are being denied their claims for disability and for injuries suffered while they served in the armed forces. We can be reached at 112 Jefferson Avenue in Port Jefferson, New York. 112 Jefferson Avenue in Port Jefferson, New York. Our zip code is 11777, and it's Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited. And
hold up just a moment. All right, well, this is Dr. Stan, and I'll go ahead and just round up. We've got about 3 minutes to round up the program, Arthur.
Oh, time flies here. Boy, it went fast.
You've got 3 minutes to round things up. What thought would you like
okay,
to leave?
Okay, I got some good news. Article by Allison Young, Detroit Free Press. Vet to get payment at last. Fighter pilot Frank Fong, who lost sight in one eye as he battled Nazis in World War II, has finally won his war against the Department of Veterans Affairs. More than half a century after he sought compensation for his injury, the VA said Tuesday it was sending Fong, 86, a check for about $67,000 in payments. They should have started making the payments in 1950. Veterans have to be persistent. If you let them jack you around, you'll get nothing, said Fong, a retired commercial artist who lives in Florida. Fong overcame discrimination as a Chinese-American to serve as a pilot, won some of the Army Air Force's highest honors for bravery and skill, 2 Distinguished Flying Crosses, and 8 Air Medals. His case was featured in March in a Knight Ridder investigation of how the VA wrongfully denies and shortchanges veterans' claims for disability compensation. Fong should receive his check within 30 days, but under VA rules, it'll be based on payment rates in effect decades ago. In 1950, his disability was worth $45 a month, which increased gradually to $274 a month by 1997. Fong will receive no interest for the years the VA didn't pay. Fong's lawyer said, so many veterans live and die without getting their compensation because they don't have access to a lawyer who can wade through all the red tape. You've got a person here who's 86 years of age, and you hope and pray he gets this small benefit while he's still alive. And Fong said,
really,
if you hadn't raised the ruckus, I'm sure nothing would have happened, Fong says of the newspaper's investigation. And here's another one you can chalk up for the good guys.
All right, fine. Well, I want to thank you. Our guest this evening has been Arthur Bernklau of Veterans for Constitutional Law, and he's out near the front lines to help the veterans. So if you have a problem, get in touch with him, and he'll either help you or get you in touch with somebody who can. Arthur, thank you so very much for being
with us. Thank you for having us, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure to work with you.
Good night, and God bless.
Good night now.
All right, fine. Well, that was Arthur Bernklau, and we like to have him on from time to time because, of course, we want the veterans to know where they can go. And unfortunately, the average American is not hearing these stories, but there are over 300,000 veterans at the present time trying to get the hearings so they can get their compensation. How many of them are the recent veterans of Iraq, the fighting over there? We don't know. But believe me, there are an awful lot of them. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. This is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. Bringing people the news behind the news, the story behind the story, the information you're not going to get through regular channels. Now, we have very real problems in America today, And as we see what's happened over in Iraq, and as we mentioned earlier, we had won the war there in 6 or 7 days. And then, of course, all we had to do was reinstall a stable government, leave the military intact, leave the police force intact, leave the civil service intact, and then let the Iraqis solve their own problems. After all we went in for was to get rid of Saddam Hussein. That's what we were told. And the truth of the matter is that is not what we went in for at all. The plan is laid out in a booklet called Rebuilding America's Defenses, published by the Project for the New American Century, which is a small little cabal. You can go to their website, newamericancentury.com. That's newamericancentury.com. Pull down their pamphlet entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses. It's about 70 pages, printed out. Read it through and study it, and if you'll find out the plan is to keep our troops permanently stationed in the Middle East. These people were demanding a war with Iraq in 1998, again in year 2000, and this everything was planned, everything was in place for the war with Iraq long before the 9/11 attack, which makes you wonder, is that why we didn't do anything to stop the 9/11 attack, knowing full well that the attack was coming? What did the administration do? Did they, give instructions that the cockpits to the planes, they were to be locked at all times so that the hijackers couldn't get in? Were orders given to have marshals on the planes or most of the planes? Or why did they, 2 months before the 9/11 attack, put out orders that henceforth no pilot will be allowed to carry a weapon on a plane? They were allowed to carry them before that. Why was it suddenly, knowing the attack was coming, why the pilots were disarmed so there'd be no way to resist the hijackers? Ladies and gentlemen, there are a lot of unanswered questions, and these are questions that most people don't want to ask. But we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men, the survival of Western civilization. And I believe we've been taken over into the Middle East. And, of course, we're going to be there. And I believe that a great war is coming. And if we attack Iran or Syria, why, we will inflame the emotions of the entire Islamic world against America and lay the foundation for World War III. So we ask you, remember, our website is www.radioliberty.com. You can pull down our newsletters. They'll verify everything we've told you tonight. We ask you, of course, to seriously consider coming to our all-day seminar on the 19th of November, but you'll have to call our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection, because we're on the front lines of this battle, a battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization.